Thanks for coming. I'm Nick Piggin. I'll be talking about NUMA page cache replicated page cache for Linux. So my talk outline, I'll give you some basically a definition of what NUMA is, and basically go through what that means for Linux, how we take advantage of NUMA currently. I'll show a particular problem in Linux's current strategy for exploiting NUMA, and then I'll get into one way that I've solved this problem, or I'm attempting to solve the problem. And to do that, I have to introduce a Linux page cache. This will be basically a non-technical kind of thing, so you know, if there's no code or anything you have to worry about particularly. And then I'll show you how my NUMA replication work can be applied to the page cache, and outline the design of the patch, again from a high level. So there's no actual getting into code. If you have really technical implementation questions or anything, maybe we can discuss that afterwards or via email. So the motivation for doing this work is that NUMA's basically becoming more prevalent, probably. It's also pushing down into the consumer space, and even embedded space. And also, not only that, but Linux is also pushing up into bigger systems. And so scalability is a very important thing, continues to be an important thing for Linux. And scalability is basically, I've got a definition there, is the ability to increase the throughput of a workload by increasing the available CPUs in a multiprocessor system. And so, for an example, AMD basically brought NUMA to the consumer with their Opteron system. If you've got a two-socket Opteron system, which is pretty common in a small server environment, then you've got a NUMA system. Intel is likely to follow this soon. And then, you know, going up all the way to big, huge systems, SGI have systems with 1,000 CPUs, I think, and 512 NUMA nodes, and they want to go as big as they can, so the better we run on these kinds of things, the bigger they can make their systems, basically. And all the enterprise kind of systems, like the Power P-Series boxes and HP Superdome systems, all things like that, they're all basically NUMA in one way or another, although they often don't advertise that fact. It was an SGI term, I think. Sorry?
Mainframes have never been NUMA.
Okay, mainframes have never been NUMA. Yep. Okay, so just to give you an idea of what... NUMA is, first of all, a typical SMP machine, this is your basically a traditional multiprocessor system, just has a single system bus, and you've got a number of CPUs hanging off this system bus, and also maybe one or two memory controllers. And so all the entities on the bus basically have equal access, and they all, if they want to communicate, they're all kind of contending with each other for access to this bus. This is a SMP, or unified memory architecture, uniform memory architecture system, because whichever CPU your process is running on, access to its memory is going to be the same as if it were running on any other CPU. It's kind of all pretty uniform. And this is really easy to program for. You don't have to worry about any kind of NUMA problems. With NUMA, it gets a little bit different. You have groups of CPUs and memory controllers one group of CPUs and memory controllers is called a node. Generally, it also has I/O controllers as well, but I won't get into that here. And so, a particular group of CPUs and memory is called a local node. So the memory is local to those CPUs, and then each of these groups is connected to one another by some kind of interconnect, and in such a way that a CPU from one group can access the memory or CPUs from another group, and this is called remote access. So accessing a remote node. And the interconnect isn't, well, it's important, but it can be anything, and it varies. One thing that I sometimes see people getting confused about is that they think Noom is a cluster. For example, I guess it's easy to get confused when you're talking about 512 node systems. It's actually, Noom is not a cluster. And definitions on this vary, but basically, if you're cache coherent, then it's a Numa system. And if you're not cache coherent, then it's a cluster. And cache coherency basically means you can run a single traditional operating system image and synchronization primitives like pthread locking, that kind of thing, they work on your global shared memory. Clusters, you've got to use special MPI calls, or you know, you've got to communicate with your remote nodes explicitly. And so, back to Numa. Why would you use Numa systems and not SMPs? And people kind of think, well, you know, Numa's crap because you're slowing down. You've got really slow access to remote memory. And actually, it's actually the other way around. It's access to local memory is really fast. It's just not possible to make such a big system with uniform access to memory. The buses and kind of communication, just the length of the physical wires involved would be make it prohibitive, maybe physically impossible to get the same kind of local memory performance of a Numa system on all your nodes. So basically, in order to scale up, you have to go. Everyone's going Numa these days, really. Another good thing about Numa is that generally your memory capability scales with your CPU count. So on my diagram here, I've got one CPU per memory controller, but you might have a group of one, two, three, four CPUs per memory controller. And so you add more CPUs, your memory controller count scales pretty linearly with that generally. So your total bandwidth goes up, which is another great feature of Numa. And Numa can support sophisticated cache coherency protocols with a bus. If someone's communicating on a bus, basically it ties up the bus for everyone, or everyone kind of sees that. With Numa systems, you can implement cache coherency such that only a few nodes ever receive any messages, and the rest of the interconnect's free for other CPUs to communicate with among each other. So just a quick kind of example system that I'll base a bit of my kind of hand-wavy theory on is the AMD Opteron system. So this is because it's probably the most widely used Numa architecture today in terms of system count, I guess. It has an on-die memory controller. So each socket has its own memory controller. And so it becomes a Numa system when you have more than one socket, because now you've got more than one memory controller. The sockets themselves communicate among one another via hypertransport interconnect. And so I've illustrated a four socket Opteron system. And you can see it's not actually a bus, it's a point-to-point interface. They're all talking directly to each other. It's not a directly connected one. You can see CPU 0 can't directly talk to CPU 2, or fully connected, I should say. And that's one of the issues.
So, yep. Do you know if the AMDs have a directory for their invalidations, or if they do broadcasting?
Okay, do the AMD Opteron CPUs have a directory for their cache coherency protocol? And the answer is no. They have a broadcast snoop. So essentially, their cache coherency, they're not taking advantage of this point-to-point interface so well in their cache coherency protocol. If CPU 0, basically this means if CPU 0 asks for asks to read a cache line into memory, from memory into its cache, it has to ask every other CPU, do you have this cache line? Is it in a dirty state? Can you please evict it and give it to me? And so I'm not going to kind of get into quite that technical level of detail. I'm basically going to skip cache coherency protocols completely. So this is kind of, all the numbers I've got here are very theoretical, and that it won't ever match up to your real-world testing. But it's just an illustration to see some of the problems. So naive NUMA support, basically this is implemented in hardware and it's to run legacy operating systems and things that aren't NUMA aware and aren't very good about, don't have any knowledge of where the memory comes from or how to allocate it. And what they do is, it's called hardware cache line interleaving.
It's more firmware than it's hardware.
Okay.
Systems can be
configured both ways. Yeah, that's true. I mean, at some level, there's got to be, I guess, some hardware support. But yeah, so thanks. And basically, this interleaves your assignment of addresses basically with as fine granularity as possible across all nodes. So your memory address 0 will be on, might be on node 0. Memory address 64 might be on node 1. Memory address 128 will be. And so basically, statistically, it tries to even out the memory allocations as much as possible. So it's kind of like, you can run this like an SMP system. If you allocate a page of memory, it's going to be spread all over your memory controllers. You're not going to hotspot the interconnect anywhere. You're going to be utilizing your memory controller. So, and this, it actually works. The problem with this is that, especially as your node count grows, the statistical, basically, probability of hitting the local memory is just going to keep going down, and you keep going to keep putting more traffic on the interconnect. And so, this is this diagram here. I'm going to have to apologize about all the crazy colors that I'm going to be using, but anyway, so if in this scheme, if CPU 0 is just reading or writing memory as fast as it possibly can on this system, it's going to have these, it's going to be, the access will be spread over all the memory controllers, and you can see kind of the amount of bandwidth it's getting out of each one and the amount of bandwidth going across the interconnect. And the red arrows are where the bottlenecks are. So these red links here are saturated. You can see you've got 4 gigabytes per second on each link to basically bring across the memory from all the other nodes. And you end up hitting bottleneck there. CPU 0 can get 10.6 gigabytes per second maximum bandwidth in an interleaved configuration like this. And in such a system, when all CPUs are reading from memory or writing to memory, using memory, you completely bottleneck the interconnect, and aggregate bandwidth goes to 21 gigabytes per second, so it about doubles. And unfortunately, you've got 4 CPUs and 4 times the memory controller capacity. You'd like to see a 4 times increase there, but I mean, this interleaving has problems. Generally, it kind of depends. Some systems have really big interconnects that could actually handle this for as many as 4 CPUs. But those, such systems will be designed for a lot more CPUs anyway, usually. So what happens is that in this naive scheme, you tend to bottleneck the interconnect. And so what Linux does now is that Linux is aware of chunks of memory are local to which CPUs. And what we do is that if a process requests some memory, so if you do a malloc call, for example, and you start initializing your data structure, Linux will allocate a local memory page for you on the CPU that the process is currently running on. And so what this means is that the Linux scheduler tries to keep processes on the same node all the time. So it's basically, if you're working on some private memory in your process, Linux should be able to allocate local memory for you. And so if we have this situation where all CPUs are independently accessing some local memory, instead of bottlenecking the interconnect, we've got negligible traffic going over the interconnect. Actually, I told you I wouldn't get into cache coherency protocols, but in AMD there is actually a lot of cache coherency protocol traffic going over the interconnect in this case as well, but we'll just ignore that and we'll just talk about memory traffic. And so in this case, that theoretical bandwidth is 51 gigabytes per second, up from 21 in the interleaving case. So it's clearly usually a good thing to allocate memory local to where to the CPUs that are using it. And this works really well if the data is only accessed by that process, by that CPU. And it'll break down if it's shared among many processes. So when does local allocation break? Is that, for example, if CPU has a thread and they allocate some big data structure, and then it spawns off a whole lot of other threads to the other CPUs, and they all want to access the data structure as well. Well, CPUs, when it allocated this data structure, Linux gave it local memory, so it's all on CPUs on node zero memory. And now all the other CPUs are trying to access this data structure as well, and you run into big problems again because you're bottlenecking the interconnect again. And so there's lots of examples where this happens really, but a typical example is shared files in the page cache. So libc, for example, your printf routine, that's stored somewhere on your disk in your libc file, and the first program to call this routine is going to pull it into memory. It's going to be residing on their local node, and from then on until the page gets reclaimed or whatever, from then on every other CPU is going to have to ask that remote node for that page. So in this case we're back down to 12.8 gigabytes per second for the record, but I think you can see it's pretty suboptimal. And so what Linux does, we've come up with I think the SGI guys kind of did a lot of this work, and the strategy for this kind of shared data, like page cache, that tends to be shared between many processes, is that we do interleaving. So this is kind of like the interleaving you saw, the hardware interleaving. It's a bit less granular. We do it on a page basis rather than a cache line basis, but it's the same idea. And this tends to be a good default. This is what we use by default. It doesn't perform a great deal better than local allocation in the case of a few processes accessing it. But if you've got a lot of processes accessing, you spread out the load on the interconnect, and it's kind of the best trade-off we can do, I think, by default. One thing we can do better for a certain class of these pages is that if they're read-only, if it's read-only data, we can actually replicate these pages across the nodes, so you have the same a copy of the same data in each node and each local memory. And if a process wants to read this data, you give them the page corresponding to the local node that they're running on. It's slightly difficult when you need to write to the data. You can't just say, okay, you're not allowed to write to any files on your file system. You have to allow for the possibility, even in the case of shared libraries, you might be upgrading a system or, I don't know, something crazy. So in that case, before writing your data, you have to get rid of all these copies, get rid of all these local copies, and just break it down, collapse it back down to a single copy before you dirty the page. And this is essentially the same idea as cache coherency protocols in hardware. They allow multiple shared copies of read-only data. As soon as one CPU writes this data, they kind of have to tear down the rest of the copies. If you don't do this, basically the file looks different depending on which node you're reading it from, which isn't a good idea. So anyway, page cache replication allows read-only shared data to be accessed from node local memory and among as many CPUs as you like. So this is optimal memory access, basically. It does use a lot more RAM, depending on how much you replicate, and it costs a lot to replicate pages and discard them if they were written to. So it's not a panacea. It's only going to be used in certain cases where it's applicable, and it'll probably need tuning and I guess even intervention from the administrators to get the exactly the right performance out of it. So that's what we can do, replication. So now I'll just give you a quick overview of the Linux page cache. Page cache is a two-dimensional data structure, and the dimensions are an inode and an offset. The inode is basically a file, and the offset's the offset into that file. And what you get out of it is a page, or no page, depending on whether the data's cached or not. And that page contains the contents of that file. And it'll be, if it's clean, it means the page contains the same contents as what's on disk. If it's dirty, it means the page needs to be written back out to disk. And Linux does this by storing a radix tree in the inode structure. This radix tree is keyed by file offset, and the contents of the radix tree are the pointers to a struct page. So in this way, if you've got an inode, you feed in an offset, you can get a page out of it. So my replicated page cache design is to perform replication on a per page granularity. I don't think it's any particularly revolutionary or new idea, although there was one patch that was kind of more trying to perform it on a per file basis, which is why I make the distinction. So replication will occur opportunistically at a couple of key points, both in the page fault path and the read system call path. So if a process reads some file memory via the read system call, the my replicated page cache will check to see whether we should replicate it and do it at that time, do the replication at that time. Or if you've mmapped a file, for example, your program text or your glibc, and you cause a fault to that, to one of the pages, it'll check at that point as well. So what it checks for is if the page is found but not on the local node, then we check if anyone else is currently writing to the page, so we can check some ref counts and check whether the page is dirty. If everything looks good, then we can make a local copy of it, and you return that to your read system call or your mmap fault handler. So just back a slide. If we look this up and we find the struct page is resides on a remote node, we can query the page and ask what node are you on. We can also query the currently running process and say what node am I on. And if they differ, then we can say, okay, we might want to make a replica here. And this replica becomes part of the page cache. So a subsequent lookup from this node doesn't have to create a new replica. It'll just find this replica we've just created. And all other paths that look up page cache, they'll first cause replicas to be collapsed before the page is returned to the requesting code. So basically, this is kind of just a catch-all. So if they might be writing to it, we don't really know, or if they're definitely writing to it, whatever the case, just collapse everything and just return a single page. And this kind of the two paths I mentioned, the read system call and the page fault, are basically the two main places where you'll consume pages for this read-only type of access. So there might be a couple of others, but as far as I know, that's not really worth kind of getting into. And you know, it'll be more intrusive if you have to put these points throughout the kernel to replicate pages. So the data structure, most important thing. It becomes three-dimensional instead of two. So now the third dimension is the NUMA node ID. The part, hopefully you can see it, the part here that I've circled is the new bit that I've added. And this is an optional third dimension. It's optional on a per-page basis. So in general, if you don't have any replicated pages, you won't incur any of the overhead of this data structure or the associated lookup. So if your pages aren't replicated, it looks the same as this, your data structure. But now if a remote CPU says reads in this page, faults in this page, whatever, and decides to make a replica, they'll set up this new third dimension, which is a little data structure which you can index by node ID. And that gives you, from there you get your page. So now every file offset can have multiple different pages associated with it. basically. Hopefully that's clear. And it's not quite trivial. The structure that I'm using now, you might not be able to see that. It's basically a simple little structure. It's got a struct a page pointer that points to the master page, and this is the guy that we fall back to if we want to collapse all the replicas. We use this master page. It's got a node mask of which nodes have local pages allocated to them. And it's got this page array. It can also be a radix tree, depending. This is one of the problems. It's kind of hard to get a nice data structure to that's not too memory intensive for this little lookup here. But basically, the page array is of size max, not num nodes, which is the maximum amount of num nodes. Yep.
Why do you need the nodes present and the page array? Couldn't a null point from the page array imply that the node didn't have a page?
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so the question was, why do I have nodes present and page array? You could just say a null stored in the page array means there's no page present there, and that's right. And I was looking at that and kind of umming and ahhing about it. I was trying to save cache lines. Maybe on small systems, well, definitely on small systems, if a page array can fit into one cache line, you could probably do without nodes present and avoid some of the computations there. So it's not too important, this little data structure. I mean, it is, but, yep. Yeah.
But the vast majority of actual systems sold have like 2, 4.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is a problem. Yeah. Okay. So on some configurations, this max num nodes is configured kernel compile time, and you want to be able to support the largest possible system you might run on, but you also want to be efficient on the common case. So page array isn't the ideal structure, I'll grant you that. And I'm actually also experimenting with using a radix tree as well. The problem with there is that I'm using the Linux page cache radix tree, and that's still, I think, 64 entries wide, each level of that. So I might have to make a new radix tree. Yep. I haven't been able to measure a great deal of performance.
So let's talk theoretical then.
Yeah.
When you're reading data that's read-only, it'll be a read-shared cache line.
Yep.
So all CPUs can cache it.
That's right.
So you're replicating these pages and populating cache lines as well at the same time somehow.
Yep.
Sounds like, right?
Yep.
So how much benefit do you get by having it local?
Yep.
Is it stuff that's long-term local? I mean, how long does it have to sit there to make it worthwhile?
It's going to depend a great deal.
Yeah.
How long does your...
Just tell us what the rules are, then, I guess.
I'll get to that a little bit further. It's kind of... It's hard. Yeah, Dave?
Just a quick observation.
Yeah.
But one thing that's funny about this tricky data structure is that, ironically, it might have been even easier to do this with the hash table.
Yeah.
You'd just be adding a new key, and you could have a new node ID equals F.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
But actually, for the purge, this would be quicker because you need to.
Yeah. So the observation was that a hash table basically can be extended to an arbitrary number of dimensions quite easily just by adding a little bit more calculation to the key, and that's right. Unfortunately, fortunately, we don't have a hash table anymore.
One more.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why do you really need it? Can't you just pick any random page from the page array?
Master can contain file system metadata.
Ah, okay. Just one of them.
And the reason why we have this master page as well, rather than just picking any random page to collapse to, or the local page that the writer's operating on, is that in a lot of cases, especially with journaling file systems, for example, the file system wants to attach metadata to a page. And so this would severely restrict the applicability, basically, of replication. And so I allow file system pages with file system metadata attached to them to be replicated in certain cases. For example, you can do this with, should be able to do this, I think, with all file systems for file data, because the file system doesn't actually directly touch this, or if they do, they might read from it just to check some it. They shouldn't be modifying the actual data in your files directly, but I have to go over this a little bit more with the file system guys, I think. But yeah, so the point is that the master page can be slightly different. It can have some metadata attached to it. Yeah.
Also, maybe one more to Dave. If we do the hashing but don't use the hash table but the B-tree, then we can look up adjacent keys within a single cache line. So maybe could, in the case of safe replication, a B-tree might make sense, more sense than a RADX tree.
It could, yeah. So this data structure is not optimal. It's pretty clear. Well, not for a generically configured. Yeah, exactly. So we don't even know if we're going to need to have to worry about doing all this if no one wants to, if no one gets any performance benefit from it. I've got to try and wrap this up pretty quickly, so I'll try and have questions at the end. So page cache lookups, basically, they're restricted to a couple of sites in the kernel that does the actual lookup for you, so that makes it quite unintrusive, the patch. Find get page is the main one, and you probably can't read that, but it just takes a per inode lock and looks up, does a RADX tree lookup on the offset you want, and if it's found the page there, then it takes a reference on it and returns it for you. So now RADX tree lookup now with my design can return a pointer either to a struct page, which is the original case, or a struct pcache desk, or this little structure that I've made in the case that the page is replicated. And you really want, because the common case is probably going to be that most of your pages aren't replicated, so you don't want to add much, if any, overhead to the case that you pick up a non-replicated page, or even for replicated pages. This is a pretty performance-critical function, so you don't want to add much overhead. So what I've done is a standard Linux trick these days of using a low bit in the pointer. Linux data structures tend to be aligned to 4 bytes minimum. You can, on some architectures, you need a little bit of an attribute to ensure they're aligned. But so if some data is aligned to 4 bytes, the low 2 bits in your pointer are redundant. They're always going to be zeros because the data they're pointing to is aligned to these 4 bytes. And so you have to mask these off. So there's a little bit of logic involved, but I'm setting the last bit to 1 if the pointer is actually a pcache desk, and the low bit 0 if the pointer is a struct page. And so that was kind of a nice little very low overhead option. And I'm introducing a new function, find get page read only. And this is the guy that tries to set up replicas. This is the one that looks for a local page. If it can't be found, try to replicate. Again, this thing will fail. If the page, well, it won't fail, it'll just return the master or the unreplicated page if it can't be replicated. And this is where I just insert this function in these 2 points. So previously where they used find get page, they now use find get page read only. The find get page, which is used everywhere else, this guy actually collapses a replica. So this guy's thinking you're going to be probably writing to this page. And this way, you only have to change these 2 call sites in the whole kernel, which makes it quite nicely unintrusive. One key thing that I kind of brushed over is that write faults, it's not only this find get page, but write faults to mmapped files must also collapse replicas. And I'll tell you what I mean by that, I think. Where am I? Well, first of all, I'll just show you how I collapse replicas. You remove the struct pcache desk from the page cache and replace it with the master page, and so subsequent references will find that master page, so just the unreplicated one. Replicas may currently be referenced for read 2 even after you've torn down the struct pcache desk, and so what this means is that you've got one process doing a read system call. They've set up a replica, taken a reference to it, and they're about to start copying data from this replica into the memory specified in the read system call. And while that's happening, if another guy writes to the page, it'll tear down this replica that the reader's got, take it out of the page cache and replace it with the master page. And they might be doing a write system call, so they'll dirty the master page and return to user space. You'll have a dirty master page, and you might still have this guy reading, chugging along here, pulling out the original data out of the replica page. This is actually okay to do this, and it's takes a little bit more than hand-waving to kind of maybe convince you. But basically, a good way to think about these kind of concurrency problems is that if it was possible to have this interleaving beforehand, then the interleaving's okay to have afterwards. And so basically, if you've got a reader and a writer that are unsynchronized to start with anyway, so they can't be one after the other, they're happening both basically the same time, to get into this situation in the first place, even without the replicated page cache, the result you could get is that either the reader might have finished completely first before the writer's dirtied any of the page, or the writer might have dirtied and the reader might get some dirty page. But the key point is the result that we get here is possible with the previous kernel. So without replicated page cache, it's possible to have this. So it's a valid semantic. If the read and write aren't synchronized, then it means the application doesn't care what happens particularly. And if it is synchronized, then we're not going to get into this situation at all. So, yeah.
You just mentioned that when you have concurrent reads and writes before replication, they serialize and the reader sees either before or after because of the page lock.
Yeah. Yep. So,
and you're not messing with that.
Yeah. Yeah, no. So, in the case that user space definitely knows a read's going first, then in that case the kernel does all the right things anyway. They'll set up the replica, the read will happen, it'll get to correct local memory, and then the write comes along and collapses it, and then dirties the page. If it happens the other way around, the reader will find the dirty data. So pages mapped into page tables must be torn down before writing to the page cache. So page cache can be mapped into user address space with mmap. We went over that, so this is your program text, glibc, or it could be even your, you know, Linux kernel source tree that GCC is mmapping. So we allow replicas in these kinds of mappings. So in your page fault path, we've got this find get page read only, and that'll set up replicas. All these guys have to be unmapped when you're collapsing replicas. For the same reasons as you need to unmap it you need to hide it from your read system call. You just don't want to see inconsistent data from different nodes. And what happens? We just unmap the PTE, and the next access to that memory causes a page fault, which maps in the correct page again. So you add a few page faults in that case, which is another reason why it can be expensive if you've got a lot of teardowns happening. And one unfortunate thing about this is that this find get page was previously a really simple function. It took one single lock, didn't sleep, was small, fast, and it gets you called from a fair few places in the kernel. And now find get page, because I've said it, this is the one that actually does the teardowns, because it has to anticipate that the call is going to write into the page. This guy has to now find all the page tables that map this page and unmap them. And this is a pretty complex operation. You can sleep, it takes a lock or two, it takes two locks, I think, two different locks. So you're significantly complicating the locking hierarchy in the kernel. And fortunately, I've had a look at this and it all looks okay. But it's just, this is one thing that's probably the downside of this patch is adding this complexity. Yeah, okay. A couple of problems with replication very quickly is threads. If you've got threads on two different nodes and they're accessing these pages via their page tables, they have to access the same page because they're sharing the same page table. And so you can't have the case where one thread in your program is accessing a local copy of GCC or libc, another thread on another node is accessing a different local copy, because they're sharing the same page table. The page table basically converts your TLB miss into a struct page, more or less, or into a page address. One One way we could do this is to replicate page tables as well, but I don't think we'll worry about that just yet.
Nick, you know, it's been going the other way, right? They're looking to share page tables between processes.
Yeah.
And you know,
sure.
You're just going to end up facing.
Hopefully that only happens for huge pages, but anyway, I've got to wrap this up. So another problem is process migration. If a process has all its memory on node 1 and the scheduler migrates it to node 2, it continues to run with all its memory mapped into now what's now remote memory because it stays on node 1. This is actually part of a more general problem with Linux NUMA memory allocation. So this isn't complete. This isn't actually specific to my replicated page cache patch. And Lee Schermerhorn's automatic page migration work is trying to solve that with this thing. And we've kind of been talking and tied both our patches in, and you know, it kind of works nicely. Basically, he has some things to try and move your memory over with your process. Code outline, 700 lines. It's about 600 in mm/replication.c. And a few hooks in the core memory management code, and it configures away without any overhead. So it's in quite a good shape, and to the stage where it could be included probably in the kernel if it has a really good case for it. Needs a few more tunables. At the moment, just has global on/off or replicate for read-only file descriptors, etc. You really want per process kind of thing or mem policy stuff to do this. And what it really needs is performance testing and positive results. And unfortunately, I haven't been able to get any numbers because I don't know how to run Oracle or TPC or anything like that. But I mean, aside from the uninteresting micro benchmarks, which don't actually mean a lot for a complex patch like this. Sorry I haven't been able to get good performance numbers. We haven't seen obvious regressions, although again, you could make micro benchmarks that give you obvious regressions. And Solaris saw about 10% improvement on OLTP on their Opteron systems. This comes back to your question about is it worth it, and it's really going to depend. Like, Opterons have quite small caches, so they can't cache a lot of this read-only. Your read-only data that I'm replicating is very easy for a CPU to cache for the same reason it's easy to replicate, because it's read-only. So on systems like Power 5, Power 6, and Itanium with huge CPU caches, they're storing a lot of these pages in their caches anyway, so they don't have to go to remote memory anyway. Opteron's got a smaller caches, so, you know, Sun saw, I think, a 10% improvement, which is very significant for a database benchmark. But, you know, bigger systems may not. They might not see any performance improvement, for example. Conclusion, it could be a good approach. Sun's results have shown that it can be of benefit. There are a lot of performance pitfalls, so it'll have to be done quite carefully, and it's going to take a long time to make any progress with it, really. But thanks for coming and listening. I'll have a couple of questions if I've got time. Yep.
So on Altix, they have this neat asynchronous block transfer device that basically does hardware based memory blockers from pages to pages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Some systems, including the Altix system, have basically hardware features that allow you to offload memory copies. Bulk memory copies especially benefit from this, i.e. page size or above. And yes, it could be possible to utilize this in creating your replicas, maybe to make this operation a little bit cheaper. I create replicas opportunistically, so at the point they're actually needed is when they're created. So you actually don't want to slow that down too much by setting up your memory copy, if possible. But yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, maybe you could make replicas of some local pages even more aggressively, i.e. before they're even requested. So you might be able to set up a few files, really commonly used files, glibc or whatever, and just say, replicate this on all nodes, because I know all nodes are going to use it. So there's some opportunities for optimization like that. Yep. Yeah.
Have you got some sort of control on how much memory is being used, some sort of hysteresis about, you know, whether it's going to start replicating all the time?
Yeah. I don't control how much memory it gets used by replicas. it'd be possible to do if you have some sort of counter and just say don't create any new replicas if you exceed this counter. I'm not sure what the best approach will be there. I think it's just going to have to be used in quite a few small specific cases. I'm not sure yet.
Will memory pressure, discarding memory pressure, will it collapse replicas? And if so, which ones decide to collapse first?
Memory pressure, so if you start having to have low memory, and enter page reclaim, thanks for the question, I didn't touch on that at all. Does it collapse replicas? And if so, is there any preferences? And at the moment, no. If it finds a replicated page, it'll get rid of it. If that happened to be the master page, it'll reassign the master page to another replica. And so it might be preferable to have a separate list of these replicas, and if there's memory pressure, start tearing them down first. I haven't wanted to spend too much time trying to really fine-tune this thing before we actually get positive performance results to see if it's even worth it. But that's a good point. That's something that will need to be investigated. Yeah. Yep.
This may horribly complicate things, but I think it's because Paul's sitting over here. I saw the read log you were using.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, it kind of a lot of this does have kind of an RCU sort of feel when we have replicated pages that are being more or less asynchronously released.
So at the moment, I use that same lock that's protecting your page tree, the existing page tree, to also protect this little data structure. So you don't have to take and release any other locks. And one of the reasons why I want to keep this data structure quite simple is because I've got some lockless page cache patches, and I want to keep this, be able to look up this data structure locklessly as well. That'll complicate things too. Yeah, true. So if you take a lock, usually the expensive operation is actually acquiring the lock, which means an atomic operation and possibly transferring the cache line from another CPU. Once you've got that, holding it for a little bit longer is not such a great deal usually. So, yeah.